Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta
right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Welcome to Ethnically Ambiguous, a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Hi, Shereen.
Hi, Anna.
This is Ethnically Ambiguous.
Yes,
it is. We have a great episode for you today. We are joined by another one of our Next Up fellows, who just dropped a podcast on iHeart called The Tongue Unbroken, so go check that out. We are joined today by Dr. Hane Lance Twitchell. Thank you for joining us, Hane.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's an incredible conversation, and his work is very important. And we talk about his podcast and his work and just the reality of the world and how important it is to know the truth, yada, yada. I'm going to shut up and you can listen to the show.
Who are we? Where do we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pants? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Hi, Shereen.
Hi, Anna. Wow.
Wow.
It's us again.
It's us again. It's a never-ending cycle where we keep showing up on this Zoom and talking to each other and putting on a record.
It really does just feel like a blur of just constantly seeing you and talking. You know what I mean?
How dare you?
I didn't say that in any mean way.
Immediately offended. How dare you? Even though technically I brought up this sort of cycle of speech, but I'm offended.
Like, I 100% know that I talk to you more than I talk to any family member or anyone in general. Like, I see you and I talk to you more than anybody. I don't have a therapist, so this is like, maybe you're my therapist, you know? Maybe not.
You should have a therapist. You should have a therapist.
It's not okay. I disagree with the notion that talk therapy works for everybody. I think other forms of therapy are better for me. That's not the topic we're going to talk about today, though.
Yes, we have a great guest joining us today on Ethnically Ambiguous. And this guest is also, there's been a theme as of late that I've been having some Next Up fellows on my show. And you know what? Today's no different. We have another great, like that tiger?
Yeah, Tony the Tiger.
Says it on cereal boxes. We have another great Next Up fellow on this episode. Honestly, their show just dropped on iHeart, but when you guys hear this, it'll be a few weeks in, so we will promote and tell you to go listen to it at some point on the show. Their show is called Tongue Unbroken. It's about, you know, Native American language revitalization and decolonization. Something important. We have Hane Lance Twitchell here. Hello, Hane.
Oh, goodness, cheese. Ach, tu yek e yin chutsati.
Wow, that's good.
Ya chutlik e. Thank you. It's nice to be with you folks. I admire you both tremendously.
Oh, okay. That's the show. That's all I needed to hear.
All right. Thank you. We just brought you on to just like
an ego boost. Yeah.
Yeah. Just elevate.
Yeah.
I don't know if I remember asking you this. I probably did, but my brain is so backlogged with every little thing that's falling apart in the world. But how did you find out about Next Up?
Okay, so I started listening to podcasts probably about 4 years ago. And then I'm not sure what led me into it, but then some roads led to the Daily Zeitgeist.
Got it.
And then that led to a few others. And then following some people on Twitter and then following you specifically to this show and then listening to this show and then being super into it to listen to people talking about issues that I think are, and maybe not just issues, but topics that are really important to people of color and in conversations with equity and conversations with safety and just, I think, really amazing things that people need to be hearing and listening and talking about. And so then I started following everybody on Twitter, follow all of you on Twitter, just to be like a, just to follow some of these conversations and then to see some of the follow-ups with some of the guests and some of the things that were being talked about. And then I saw this advertisement through Twitter, some sort of promotion that people were sharing about the Next Up initiative. And I had previously tried to do some radio shows here in our community. I live in Occoquan, Ani, which is, I guess on the map, is named after a white guy named Joe Juno. Oh. And it's in Alaska. And so I had sort of done a little bit of practice in thinking about how to start sharing a message. And then I'd been really curious about podcasting. And so I threw my name in the hat. And I said, well, what if we did something on Native American language revitalization, which is maybe a topic that not everybody's talking about, but everybody should be thinking about and probably talking about a lot more.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's kind of what drew me to your pitch, because no one else pitched anything like yours in the application process. And I was like, well, that feels like an easy yes. But at the same time, you know, we interviewed you as part of our like top 20 and you were just all good vibes. So I was like, well, I just like Rene. So I think he should be part of the program.
Sheesh.
Yeah. Does that mean thank you?
Oh, yes. Yes, that does mean
thank you. That's interesting. I've heard that so many times that even now I know it. And did you see I wrote it in your card?
Yes. That was so wonderful.
I'm learning.
Wait, can you say it one more time?
Yeah, it's gonna sheesh. So the first sound is g.
G.
And the second sound is nush.
Gunna.
There's a voiceless L there, which is a sound that sometimes people make if they have a lisp, they will make that sound. So it's like you're going to make the letter L, but you just blow out the sides of your mouth instead of using your vocal cords. And then the last sound is cheesh. So when you put them together, it's gunach cheesh.
Gunach cheesh. I'll get better. But I do agree that reviving Indigenous language is so important because there are only so many things that can connect us to culture, right? And like as centuries go on, like what is that? What is the thread that reminds us like, oh, we exist, right? It's like this language. It's, yeah. So I want to know, I guess just to rewind, to talk about you. Were you born and raised in Alaska or in the territory that is now known as Alaska?
Yeah, I was born in a town called Skagway, which we call Wushikakuya or Shkakwe. And then I was raised in Anchorage, which is, it's a city for Alaska. It's probably not quite city-sized if you're coming from Los Angeles or somewhere like that. But it's pretty good size. And then, so I grew up there. And then I went to college at the University of Minnesota.
Oh.
And I didn't know anything about our language, and I didn't know very much about our culture either. And then my grandfather, who had always been pretty close to, he got sick, and so I went home to help him. And then I realized through his sister that he was the only one who could speak our language in our family. And then I said, well, why don't you teach me the language? And so we started, you know, he tried to teach me a word, like we got all these fun sounds. And so he'd point at the salt on the table and he'd say, H. And I would try to say that and he would laugh at me because that's how he was. He just liked to laugh at people. So goal number one became get him to stop laughing at me. And then I want to laugh with him and not be laughed at. But I don't usually use that as a teaching technique, but it worked for me.
That's a beautiful way to learn. Like the circumstance isn't ideal, obviously, but I love that inspired you to learn your language. What were you studying at university?
Well, so I went in kind of more or less a first generation college student. Mm-hmm. And went in, the first college I went to was a place called Mankato State University, which I think is called Minnesota State University. And I just realized what it was like to be, I guess in Anchorage, about 20% of the population, probably when I was growing up, was Alaska Native. So you just had one out of every five people were indigenous, which is not very common, I think, in the United States outside of maybe New Mexico. Certainly if you get to a reservation, then you have a high percentage. But at the first college I went to, there were about 16,000 students, and there were 16 Native American students, like all together. And so we started hanging out together and then just sort of thinking about being together. And Mankato is an interesting place. I didn't have very many positive experiences there outside of getting to know some mentors in the Native American community. But historically, it's the site of the largest public execution in U.S. history. And they were all Native Americans. And there was a little plaque in the middle of downtown that commemorated this event. And I think there was a very strange residue in that town. But I think growing up, my father went to a boarding school and he was abused and his sister and brother were abused there. He didn't tell me about that until right before he passed away. But I think because of that, and it was an interesting kind of experience because his parents were going through a hard time and chose to put three of their kids into a boarding school as opposed to having them being taken. Hmm. And so I think he had a lot of hard feelings towards his parents and he had a lot of hard feelings towards religion in particular. It was a Catholic boarding school. Hmm. They did horrible things to all of them, to all of the kids that were there, at least to my parents and auntie and uncle. And so we grew up in this sort of absence of a lot of culture. I think he kept us from a lot of things, trying to deal with his reaction to the violence of the world, and then trying to also deal with a lot of things that he was struggling with. But he gave us a very good life and a very good start, mm-hmm. even though he had a hard time himself. And so, but being around a lot of Native American people, or just very few, and then trying to realize that I hadn't come to an understanding of my own identity in terms of my ethnicity and my heritage of being Tlingit and Haida and Yupik. And so thinking of that and then talking to other people who had a very strong sense of identity, who were dancing and who were learning their language and speaking it, then it started to awaken this other thing where I started to think about who I was and what that meant and how to connect. And language was the pathway that connected me to being Tlingit and understanding.
That's incredible. Language is like the deep connection factor. I mean, like outside of like, it's literally how we communicate, but like knowing your mother tongue, if you are from a certain culture, is so like, it's a game changer. It allows you to communicate. And I have a lot of like feelings on that, like with my family being in Iran and like half my family being like Azeri Turkish while living in Iran is that they speak a different dialect. And so it's harder to communicate with them. And I've, in later years in my life, as I've grown, kind of like what happened with you, I've become more obsessed with learning these languages because like, what happens when my dad's gone? I lose that connection. Like, that's not fair to life. Like, I that's not fair to anyone. Like, and to make that effort, I think, is like very important.
Yeah. And language and identities is very complicated when you throw in like a whole bunch of racism.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was talking with a dear friend of mine today who he's from Los Angeles and He's a Latinx person, and so he has identities with his own Mexican heritage, but then he's not a highly fluent speaker of Spanish, and we talk quite a bit about growing up, and if you have an accent that sounds like you're from a particular area, then white people are going to be mean to you. But then if you try to learn Spanish, and sometimes your family is also going to be mean to you because you don't sound authentic.
Yeah.
And that happens mm-hmm. with indigenous peoples as well, which is complicated again by American genocide of Native American peoples and just mm-hmm. how substantial and intentional it was to try and eliminate every single language that was here when white people arrived.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Great way to, any sort of like infighting like that. I mean, it's all, I think, a symptom of white supremacy. We all just become a part of it. And you find ways to lessen other people for not having, being a certain way. And even if it's like when I'm in Iran and I speak and people are like, wow, you speak Farsi with an American accent. It's like, why are you othering me right now? Like, mm-hmm. you're my like aunt, you know, or whatever. You're like a family friend. Like, what's the point of like making me or pointing out that I'm different? Like, there's no real reason to do that. It's unnecessary. So like, but I do feel like genuinely, like, even if it's like not necessarily because I'm not, you know, doesn't necessarily in that moment have to do with whiteness, but is that symptom is literally what white supremacy teaches you, is to mm-hmm. put yourself above others for one reason or another, which is like, you know, runs rampant within all over the world because of, you know, European and Western influences, which is hell, but
yeah,
crazy.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, there's like colorism and like almost like purism in every culture, right? There's like this idea that like you're not enough of X, Y, and Z either way. And all that does is like isolate the person in question, right? And like, and it's not fair because like in your case, in my case, or whatever, it's like we're all just trying. We're trying our best to like exist and like communicate, and it's important to us. And I remember being so discouraged from speaking Arabic because I had a funny accent as a kid. Like, As I grew up, my accent isn't the greatest, and I wish I had talked more, and I'm trying to like redo that now, just because like I can remember exactly how I felt, that like shame of how people would like react, like my cousins or like anybody, you know what I mean? So I never plan on having kids, but my sister who was saying like her kid knowing Arabic is like the ultimate priority. Like, she's gonna go to my parents' house. The only thing you can speak to her is Arabic. So it's like, yeah, it's like this whole, I don't know. It's just, it's a thread to identity, and it's a thread to like something so much deeper than, I don't know. I'm just rambling. But yeah.
Well, no, I think you're right. I think also what we're looking for is this multiplicity of the identity can be multiple things. It doesn't have mm-hmm. to be just one particular thing, and it doesn't also have to be two. It could be many different things. And so we have, my wife and I, we have three kids, and before they were born, I sat down with Mariah, and we sort of talked. We had one friend, she was a teacher of mine, and she was British, and I like to listen to her say the name that's on my taxes. So she'd say, my name is Lance Twitchell, and she'd say, Lance, you know, and that was very fun. And I was in creative writing classes, and she'd say, what's this bloke doing, you know, and her name was Jerry Brightwell, and she was amazing. But when she would talk to her kids, I would notice she would speak French. And I don't know French, but I could spot it when I hear it. And I said, well, why are you speaking French to your kids if you're from England? And she said, well, my mother was French, and we only spoke to each other in French. And so speaking to my kids in French is how I keep my memories of my mother alive. Wow. And it's also part of our identity. And at the same time, we had a friend who was from Uruguay, and she would speak to her son exclusively in Spanish. And so mm-hmm. we started thinking about this one parent, one language household. And we said, I think we could do this. And so when we had a baby, I would just sit there and look at this baby and think, what am I going to say to you, baby? Like, my language isn't even that good. Like, my fluency was still building. And now I have to communicate the entire world to someone and help shape their worldview. But it worked. So we just kept trying. We had two additional children, and I would only speak to them in Tlingit. And at the time, there were not very many children, maybe just a couple, who had been spoken to in Tlingit since they were born. we have maybe 40 speakers left in the world. And so wow. trying to raise children in the language. But then there were some things I would notice as the kids started to grow older. Sometimes they would feel a little, you could see they felt a little embarrassed of us speaking to them in our language in front of people who didn't know. Sometimes they would translate for people. But she was just playing, the oldest one, she was just playing with her friends. We were in a community called Sitka a few years ago. And I told her something in our language, and she responded. And then one of her friends said, "What language are you speaking?" So I turned to my daughter and I said, I said, "What language is it? Tell them." And she turned to them and shrugged and said, "Human language?" With like, you know, and she kind of questioned. She didn't really know how to answer that. And I thought that was wonderful that she didn't mm-hmm. have to separate them really in her mind.
Wow. That's cool.
I feel like I had a little bit of embarrassment in my youth because maybe because there weren't a ton of Persians, but I will always be like, because my parents did that too, where they like obviously spoke Farsi to me, so I could be sure to maintain my Farsi, but I would like respond in English because I'd be like ashamed. You know, mm-hmm. I didn't even get at that point, like, what a great opportunity to talk shit about everyone around you. You know, like, you can really get that gossip train going when you have a different language that people don't understand. But at the time, in my youth, it was more just like all about fitting in. You can't mm-hmm. really appreciate like what your culture has to offer because you're kind of like stuck in that like young state of mind. So that's like really cool that your daughter's like.
Yeah.
She's unimpressed by such questions.
Yeah. I like her. And then we talk about a lot of other stuff as well, because my wife, their mother, she's half Iranian, and then she's Inupiaq in Dutch. And so they also have connections to other parts of the world that we have to figure out and learn about. And I want them to understand that and just say, like, all of these different things are parts of me. And I am connected to these different places, and I'm connected to these different languages, which I think is a challenge because America is just generally wants to be monolingual and somewhat monocultural.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, so you've got these hegemonic forces that you're consciously and subconsciously sort of pushing back on. And then you want to raise kids who don't feel bad about who they are and that don't look down on others because of who they are. And it's a challenge to raise them and to sort of get them to be that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a thought about that, but let's first take our first break and I'll bring us back and we'll talk again.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am like I am where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick.
I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s,
she looked like a million bucks,
with zero qualifications,
she had a Harvard plaque,
tricks her way past a wall of lawyers and agents.
She's got all of these Maseratis and Bentleys all in the driveway.
Is it like a mansion?
Yes, it's a mansion that this queen of the con uses to scam some of the biggest names in professional sports out of untold fortunes.
About $6 million.
Approximately $11 million.
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
Employing whatever means necessary to bleed her victims dry.
She would probably have sex with one of her clients.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. We were talking about the importance of raising children with language, because I just firmly believe language is like the most important superpower to have. So if we like just really prioritize that as human beings and like teach our children all these languages that are so important growing up, I think no one is. Yeah, because you're right. American culture is trying to be really monocultural and monolingual. And I remember I was just thinking about how I remember being a kid and being self-conscious because sometimes kids would react about how things were said, like the pronunciation of things. Like my uncle, his name is Mufuk, right? That has the word fuck in it. And all like, little things like that where it's like, oh, in this language, that sound is funny. And in my language, that sound is just a word. So it creates this thing where it's like the basis is English and everything that like is entertaining to that is like what it does that make sense? It's almost just like limiting you from having your baseline be your native language, because I do consider Arabic my native language. I'm fluent in it. It's like I think it in my brain, but I do remember feeling like almost playing along with how funny it was that certain words sounded like this and like that. And I don't know. It's just your daughter has this good head on her shoulders. She's going to be just fine.
Yeah. And we get that here. Like, so I went to a preschool, our kids went to a preschool, and it was, kids from all over the place, you know, and they were playing Duck, Duck, Goose. And so Doc, if you were to say Doc in Tlingit, which sounds like duck, that means out to sea. So you'd be like, oh, mm-hmm. out to sea. But then if you say goose in Tlingit, it means vagina. And so we'd have to come and say, you know, my kids speak Tlingit, so can we say gray duck?
Yeah. Instead,
or can we?
That's so funny.
Can we use Tlingit words?
I mean, I'm just doing the same thing I just did, but we're in reverse. But I think that's fine. I think if it's you know what I mean? Sorry, yeah, I'm talking to myself. Yeah.
So let's talk a little about after college and you know, starting to learn Tlingit from your grandfather, where did you go from there? Like, what did you decide to do with your life? Like, how did you even get into language revitalization? Was it just like from interacting with your grandfather or?
Well, I think once I started to learn Tlingit and then I realized so few people were learning it at that, it was 1996 when I started to try to learn Tlingit. And then there was kind of this neat converging moment. So we had a Native American student center at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. And I found this book, and this book was called Stabilizing Indigenous Languages. And it was probably 20 years later, I was invited to be like a keynote speaker at the Stabilizing Indigenous Language Conference. And I told the story. And then there was a second chapter to the story, which was this guy came up to me there and he says, hey, I was the editor of that book. And I just happened to be driving through Minnesota and I had boxes of them. And I said, oh, they got a college. I'll just drop them off at their Native Student Center. So he just happened to drop them off there. I happened to find it. I was very intrigued by all the things that they said in this journal about Native American languages and what was happening and why these things have happened and what people are doing about it. And so I wrote a paper for an upper-level English class that was called Stabilizing Indigenous Languages. And I got a C- on the paper. Ah! They didn't write any comments. The only thing they wrote on the paper is, why doesn't everybody just speak English? So then I was like, okay.
That was a genuine gasp. I cannot believe.
Why doesn't everyone just speak English?
So it was fighting time. So I went to, so that was stupid. A TA. Yeah.
That would enrage grading, me. Right? That would.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, but it lit a fire. So then I took, you know, I was took it to the teacher. I took it to the dean. I took it to the head of the English department. And I was pissed. But then I also realized that there was something that we had to do to shift the consciousness of people to sort of not just raise, we don't have to just raise awareness to indigenous languages. We have to actually recreate spaces. We have to shift people's understanding, because I think it's kind of un-American to examine just how much America has done, the United States anyways, and also Canada, to examine what they have done through residential schools and boarding schools and just general indigenous language and culture prohibition.
Right.
And then to look at that with a sense of, okay, we need to understand what happened, and then we need to understand how to shift systems so we can have systemic changes so that we don't have an end result of genocide, but we have a narrative of attempted genocide, and then we have an end result of revitalization and reclamation.
So what happened to that TA?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't really remember. I think my focus then was just anger. But then not long after that, my grandpa passed away, and I felt very bad because he asked me to come back home. And I said, I had one semester left and then I'll come home. And then he passed away, and I kind of fell off my journey for a while. And then I kind of started getting back. The language kept bringing me back and bringing me back. And then I finished my bachelor's degree eventually, and then went to Fairbanks and was studying. I thought I was just going to become a poet and write books and just hang out with poets all the time, which I think would be wonderful. But I kept getting called back to teach our language, to go to language camps. And then one of my mentors, his name was Richard Dauenhauer, he was getting ready to retire. And he was teaching and also coordinating Tlingit language classes as a non-Tlingit, a non-Indigenous linguist. And I talked to him. I said, hey, maybe I can take your job when you retire and just sort of try and do what you did. And he said, yeah, you should. And so I applied for it. I just finished an MFA, and I came down and interviewed for the position. There were two other candidates who were both white males with PhDs in linguistics. And I got the job. And so it was really amazing to make connections to learners and to start thinking about, well, how would I get someone on a path to become a speaker of Tlingit? It's a very difficult language.
Right.
Conceptually, it's very tough. There's all these wild sounds that we got to make, you know, which I was trying to have this challenge where you put like three saltine crackers in your mouth and you chew them twice. And then you try to say, which would be,
whoa, how do you do that?
The swan's cliff is sliding. It doesn't really make a whole lot of sense, but, because then you got to be able to say that without any crackers coming out of your mouth.
Yeah, I could barely say that with no crackers. Right. God forbid I had a cracker in my mouth. That's wild.
That's so beautiful.
I'm curious, after your grandpa died, like, how did you continue learning Tlingit, even though it was like such like a hard language to find? Like, how do you study it?
Yeah, there are these two speakers. Her name is Kehne Nora Dauenhauer, and another one, his name is Kunak Fred White. And they had made this recording of like these conversations and these lessons, and they worked together with Richard Dauenhauer to create this book on called Beginning Tlingit. And so I got that book, and I got the dictionaries, and I tried to study, and I was walking around the University of Minnesota campus with obviously nobody to talk to. But I was like, well, I can learn all the names of things. So I just made flashcards and right. just would practice all the nouns and just say, well, I can at least learn all these names of things. And then I think in 2000, the summer of the year 2000, I went to a language camp and I realized I didn't know how to talk. Like, I could name a bunch of stuff, but to be able to communicate to people who can speak the language was something then I really wanted. Because even then, going back 22 years ago, a lot of our speakers knew we were losing our language and they were running out of people to talk to.
Right.
So then I think the next, I went from not getting laughed at. I don't want to get laughed at. I don't want people to be racist towards us and I'm angry. And then I transferred to, I want to be able to talk to these older people who are getting lonely. And I wanted to be able to tell them in our language, if you tell me what you want people to know, I will try to teach them. And then that's what sort of pushed me to a higher level of fluency. And then after that, it was probably translation work, working with these two 92-year-olds who were just such a gas. They were so fun to hang out with and to listen to their stories and to translate stuff that was recorded in the 1950s by people who were probably in their 90s then.
Wow.
Well,
that's wild.
Everything, you are a very poetic person. There are some sentences you say that I'm just like, what the? Well, you're very wise. But yeah, I think it's a good reminder of how many other cultures utilize, like, linguistically, like, more parts of their body to speak. It's not just like this front center or whatever that English uses. Like in Farsi or Arabic, we use like the throat. We use like kha and ha. And you have these like clicks that are just like so, I don't know, like melodic. I just think it's very important to reshift what we assume the a default is. I don't even think we consciously do it. I think we just operate that way. But yeah.
Yeah, well, so then I think there was a language conference in Hawaii that a colleague of mine, a friend of mine, his name is Tseosh James Crippen, he said, we should go to this language conference in Hawaii and talk about how we come to consensus with our language. I was like, oh, that sounds great. So I go to Hawaii, and it was amazing. Then it included this tour in Hilo, Hawaii, of their language school. And it absolutely blew my mind. They had a College of Hawaiian Language. They had their own building. Then they had these language nests, which are preschools, essentially, that just raise children entirely in the language. And then they had an entire K-12 language medium school. So then I went back the next year for another language conference. And I happened to sit at a table with some of the most influential people in Native American language revitalization. There was Larry Kimura. There was Pila Wilson, there was Kawanoi Kamana, Namaka Rollins, and then there was a Mohawk lady there, and her name was, I think, Dorothy Lazur. And so when I was sitting with them, I just started talking to them about what we're trying to do in our country and then talking about what they're doing, and I got invited to apply to their PhD program. And so I did, and then when I started going over there and learning some critical concepts of what they did and how they did it. I learned some Hawaiian, and it was really just incredible to look at what they've done, where they went from probably maybe a couple hundred remaining speakers on Earth to more than you can count. It's well over 10,000 now, and they're on this trajectory of growth, and their language exists all over the place. They can speak it, and just hearing how they overcame their own internal doubts. They're also, you know, you talked earlier about purity. We have like language purists as well who would tell you don't say it unless you could say it right. And that just shuts people up all the time because you don't say that to babies. Like if a baby's learning a language, it's like, hey, baby, you say that right or you just don't say anything. But we do that to each other in these language learning environments. So we started looking at what they did. And I think the number one message we got was, create a loving home where the primary language is your language. And that's what we try to do.
That's incredible. Mm-hmm. You ended up going to, that's the program you graduated from with your master's?
It's a PhD.
PhD? You're a doctor?
Yeah.
Honey, yeah, you never told me this. I would have been calling you Dr. Tuchel in that voice.
Well, I was running around with my kids and the oldest kid, she was telling her two younger siblings, she said, Dad's going to be a doctor. Not like a doctor that like operates on people, but what kind of doctor, Dad? So I said, Yuchatank Kunagu, which would mean language doctor. It's just sort of putting these two words together. And she said, word doctor. I was like, I'll take that.
I love that. That's so pure, like as a, I don't know, like just not affected by the reality of like scummy life, if that makes sense. It's just like
right.
Word doctor. Do you like being called doctor? Should we refer to you as doctor?
Well, I don't insist on it. Like, if people call me a Kone, then they're speaking our language, and that's a really good thing.
Yeah.
Can't believe I had no idea you were a doctor this whole time.
I mean, I like that you were humble about it, at least, right? You're honest. Yeah.
I am winning. I had a friend, and he said, like, I'm humble. Yeah, I'm humble. And then I was teasing him, so I said, yeah, I'm humble. I'm really humble. In fact, I'm the best at it.
I'm the most humble person you've ever met. Like, I'm so humble. I do love that. Because it's just not humble. Where's the line?
Yeah, there is. It's a very, let's call it, oxymoron statement.
Oh, yeah.
I want to know about your podcast and stuff, but I think it's going to be a longer conversation. So maybe we'll take our second break first, and we will be right back.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because, God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rock the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James! LeBron James!
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back with Dr. Kone. Okay, doctor. Let's talk about your podcast, Tongue Unbroken, out now. Go check it out on iHeartRadio, wherever you get your podcasts. Let's get into it.
Yeah, I was really excited to put this together. And I'm really thankful for the Next Up Initiative and for this amazing cohort of 8 people who have important voices and who support each other. I remember there are some points where we're going through our podcast training and where we really just talked about stepping out from the margins and how it felt like we were just kind of holding each other's hands and stepping out from these areas where we had been hiding or had been pushed. And for a variety of us, just thinking about how we can continue to find voices that don't often make it to the front of things just because of the way things go. And so thinking about Native American language revitalization, there's a number of things that I like to focus on. And part of it is what's going on to shift the narrative. What are these amazing stories that we can listen to? So we're going to have some conversations with folks in Hawaii and folks in Six Nations, the Mohawk people, and folks who run schools who are speaking the Anishinaabe, the Ojibwe language. And then we're also going to have some conversations with folks who are sometimes struggling and talking about what they're going through and what they're trying to accomplish in their journeys. Then there's other portions where we need to raise awareness to what has gone on. Like, there's a lot of people who probably don't have a real understanding that the death of Native American languages is an intentional act. Like, it was a desire of an entire government, of entire like groups of religions that were very active in abusing children and abusing people.
Yeah, that was like the main focus of those boarding schools, right? That was just like to essentially whitewash those kids and make them like, I think I was reading like anything that made them in their eyes, like quote unquote, like getting like washing the savage out is what I read, like one of this history book that I was working on, this audiobook. But this audiobook actually, it was about indigenous culture, and the reader was indigenous. And just hearing him talk, I'm not very coherent in this podcast. What I'm trying to say is I learned a lot even just working on that audiobook. And I realized, like, even though I think I'm fairly educated, I don't know a lot either. And so it just made me realize, like, how much history and pain is, like, accumulated and, like, forgotten, and just how much white men have written history books and, like, written their own narrative about it. It's just so important to tell our own history, I realized. It's, like, coming from the source.
Yeah, and I don't think I'll get any free chicken nuggets from this little story, but I was at a hockey game in Fairbanks, and this McDonald's commercial comes on, and it says, "Kill the hunger, save the man." And it ruined my entire experience, because when Native American boarding schools were envisioned in the United States, it was under the guidance of this guy named Henry Pratt, or Richard Pratt, I think his name was. Maybe it was Richard Henry Pratt. And he kind of gave this speech where he said, This great general once said, "The only good Indian is a dead Indian," and I would like to counter that you can kill the Indian and save the man. And then he just sort of pitched this idea, and then they developed this idea where children would be sent to these schools, and then they would be punished for speaking their language. And there's quite a few of us who have done some work to figure out, like, what did they do to you? What happened at these places? What was it like? And the level of violence is horrifying. One of the elders that I talked about earlier working with, her name was Shukshani Marge Dudson, and she talked about her first day of school when her older sister said, "You can't speak Tlingit there. You get in big trouble." And she just saw people she knew, and it's just a language. You can't get, like, send a five-year-old out somewhere and say, "Don't speak English anywhere you go," and then have them see all their friends and stuff. Mm-hmm. It's not going to work.
Yeah.
So she just starts speaking, and the teacher calls her up in front of the class and picks her up by her hair, shakes her violently, and threatens to do her more harm if she keeps speaking. And, like, that's day one. And so sometimes, like, I want to look at that stuff. I want to examine it and say, has education shifted? Have religious organizations who were some of the architects of this stuff as well, have they come to grips? The Pope, as recently in late July, I think, was in Canada to apologize to people of First Nations for what has happened. And I think that's a step. But then I also think there needs to be some pretty groundbreaking initiatives, like maybe churches should be taxed, and then maybe that money should go towards Indigenous language and culture revitalization. Mm-hmm. And maybe there should be A friend of mine here, Pat Reyes in Juneau, had this idea. What if you just added a tiny amount to everybody's property tax, and that went towards Indigenous land back initiatives and language back initiatives? Because there's a lot of hands that are dirty from this attempted genocide, and whether people are conscious of it or not, and whether they were agents of it or not, we all inherit this collective situation. And so I think a lot of things can change. And so some of the things that we're looking at in Alaska and that we want to talk about through this opportunity, through this podcast, is what if everybody who graduates high school takes a semester of an Indigenous language? What if we just normalize the fact that people should know something about it, and they should know some things about Indigenous peoples and their histories and their languages? And it's not going to hurt anybody. It's actually going to be a really neat thing.
I mean, I think that's so important, because I think it's very easy in this country to ignore what happened to Native Americans, because you're like, it was so long ago. Well, what does it matter now? What's the big deal? And it's something that, like, I remember, you know, when we were doing, well, what am I talking about? When we're always talking about, like, Palestine versus Israel, we had one person be like, well, then how do you feel about what Americans did to Native Americans? As if trying to be like,
yeah,
why are you guys so hard on Israel when you guys did that first? And it's kind of like, well, that's beside the point. Like, this person arguing with us, I was like literally about to be like, go to hell, leave us alone.
Also just assuming so much in that statement.
Yeah, but like, it was a very interesting thing that I thought about of like, yeah, I mean, yes, it's a problem. Yes, we act as if because it was so long ago that we don't owe Native Americans everything, you know, like, but... You know, obviously a different situation, you know, similar situation, but also kind of like a more complicated situation going on with Israel and Palestine. The fact that we already did that and we're allowing it to happen again is very telling, you know, of like, well, then this point doesn't really matter to me at this point, because then why are we doing it again? But whatever, that's all an aside. I digress. But it does, I think it is important to, one, everyone needs to know, two, like, I think, like, having a class on it is, like, the bare minimum, right? Like, it's like, oh, now you're kind of learning. And, you know, in history class, you touch on it. You talk about these sorts of things. But it's never, like, stressed of, like, we massacred people. This was a genocide. And now we sit in our computers in our classrooms or whatever and, you know, go on Twitter and pretend like we didn't just, like, destroy people. To be sitting here on Twitter, right? So, like, I think it's just, there has to be more. There just has to be more. And it's really sad when, like, the government's like, God, stop looking at us, you know? And you're like, I don't know about you, but I can't, you know, like, I can take small steps in my life, in my community, but, like, it needs to be recognized on a larger scale. Things need to be done. You can't just be like, here's a casino, stop complaining. You know, it's like this crazy shit that you see all the time where they're like, well, they were given that. But then you're like, okay, that is truly an insane way to look at things.
Yeah.
Like, you can't cover up the problem. Like, you can't be like, oh, sorry, like, now there's been a systematic demise of your existence since we genocided you. Like, what is, and, you know... Honestly, Hone, I've learned so much from you as a person. Well, and, like, I just, even, like, certain words that we say, like, you've taught me so much, and you've made me feel so much to a point, like, when I do hear people talk about reservations and, like, how they speak about them, like, I was in another state in Northern America where we were driving through a reservation and the people I was with said some stuff. That really, like, it was like on the lines of like, they don't take care of themselves. And I was like, are you fucking kidding me? They don't take care of themselves? We did that. We created the system that now they have to live in poverty. Like, it's not that they don't take care of themselves. That's like such a blanket fuck you statement to these poor people who just, like, were trying to live. And we came in and we're like, ooh, no, I want a super mall. You're like, yeah, I want a mall here, whatever the fuck. But, like, I've learned so much from you, and I've really enjoyed getting to know you. And I feel like just from like interacting with you in like meetings or just even listening to your episodes, like I feel like my whole world in regards to Native American culture has opened up significantly. And I think it's like that's why your show is so important, because like people like me who I feel like I'm doing something for people of color and just marginalized communities, there's so much more out there that I feel like I could learn. And I think like your show, even though I live in America, I have a very light understanding of Native American culture outside of what we appropriate and wear at music festivals, obviously. But like, you know, we're such monsters. But like,
but that's on purpose. The government did that on purpose.
Yeah, right? I know. But it's just I just really want to stress to everyone listening to like go listen to your show. Because yeah. Like I just think it's so important. And I think you do such a great job of also, and you shouldn't have to do this, but you make it so engaging. Like it shouldn't have to be like digestible in the way that you do it, because it's just important in general. But I think you do such a great job at that. So thank you. Thank you.
Goodness cheese.
I was thinking about how you have a great voice and calming presence. I think your podcast is going to be amazing. It is amazing.
It is amazing. It's out now. Go listen. Tongue Unbroken. It's linked in the description, baby.
It is amazing. You're right. I heard it and it was great. The United States wants us to have a very base level or not even any knowledge about what happened. Like, it's purposeful that we're all like, what? Like, why is everyone talking about X, Y, and Z? Like, I don't understand the history of this. It's all on purpose, again, because like they've structured history in their image or whatever. And I think something that's really the argument that bothers me the most about the attempted genocide is that like that's just like what happens for progress. Like that's like man lands somewhere, they take over a place, and then they continue. And I really get bothered by that, because it's like they would never have survived without indigenous people. Like, how to grow plants, how to grow food, how to just like use the land. And the idea of progress in different cultures is so important to realize, because like there's no such thing as like uncivilized and civilized. It's like your definition of what you think that means. They had, like, from what I understand, indigenous culture had such a like sacred view of this earth and like the way they cultivated it and everything, and a very generous culture. And then here comes this fucking greedy white man and utilizes that and takes advantage of that. I think it's disgusting. That shouldn't be considered civilized. I think that's the argument that bothers me the most, is just because I believe they were like far more intelligent than any white man that they encountered. But I don't know, ramble. But yeah, your podcast is really important for all the reasons that Anna was saying, because hearing history from someone that like it's so important to you, and it should be so important to all of us. But I don't know, it's just thank you for taking initiative and being like, this is an important thing that is important to me and that I should do.
Yeah, a lot of Native American cultures have trickster narratives, and they're, for us it's Raven, which, you know, I got reminded because I brought some compost outside and we have a bucket the other day. And I was like, oh, I'll just put an extra bag on top of the bucket. And 3 minutes later, I walked outside and it scattered everywhere, because our ravens are very smart and very good at getting into things. But I think trickster narratives were presented to us because they had to get us ready for what was going to come. And I think these trickster narratives are going to help us, because decolonization requires a lot of seeing through the illusions and putting aside the distractions. And so, like you talked about with Palestine, I think a lot of it is, oh, well, what about this thing? Oh, what about that thing? It's like, no, actually, we were talking about this right here. Like, it doesn't matter who parked in your spot. It doesn't matter who you think is violent. And it doesn't matter who you think is terrible. We actually need to talk about this particular thing. And I think there's a clip from Ronald Reagan. I think he was asked somewhere, because he was telling people to be nice or whatever. And someone said, well, what about the Native Americans? And he gave this long speech, and it's very strange to listen to, where he basically says, well, we asked them to come and live with us, and they said, no, they'd rather just stay where they are and stay in the past. And I don't understand that, right? So you have to constantly dismantle these notions of progress and superiority and this idea that Native Americans are somehow primitive or mm-hmm. less. And I think that's very, very prevalent in so many different things, where we have people who've written books about our people. And then when we talk about making a language school, he says, well, what are you going to do about getting them ready for the real world
in
the modern world? And I said, oh, well, we're really real and we're really modern, so it's fine. You know, and so, but they have to deal with this stuff in Hawaii as well. So it's also mm-hmm. a lot of just continually destroying the myth of superiority, and also this myth of that Native Americans weren't even doing anything, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there are so many sophisticated things and so many wonderful things that were already here and that were in development, and I only wish we're allowed to develop like everybody else was.
Yeah. That's a crime that was taken away. It was just stolen. Like, the growth and
the future, everything.
Yeah, it was stolen. Just like the land. It's all tragic. And I think, instead of like being like, whoa, this is so sad, I'm glad that there's like actionable things we can do as like teaching ourselves, teaching others, because having actionable things, I think, helps people digest it a little better. Because like, I don't know, I've just heard in so many issues, people are just like, well, I can't do anything about it. Like, what's the point? Like, I can't implement change. And that's where the importance of community comes in, right? Like, you learned your native language because of a community, because people thought it was important. And I think that's how progress has to happen. Like, we're seeing it now with like mutual aid stuff. Like, it's all community. It's not any kind of bigger institution.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that, like, that's a silver lining to all of this, is like, we've realized the importance of community, and hopefully that emboldens people to learn about things that don't directly affect them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, everybody anywhere can contribute. And so whether mm-hmm. that's learning an indigenous language, supporting the language groups that are going forward, advocating for inclusion in schools, advocating for restoration of indigenous place names. We don't need 100 freaking places named after Bob and Jim and Joe, because those places already had names. Yeah. And people tell us, like, why are you changing the name? Like, we didn't change it. Y'all's ancestors changed it, and we're just mm-hmm. restoring it. And then there's also other things that people can do. They could donate to language groups. They can give money to they give land back to indigenous peoples. And so there's a lot that can be done, and there's a lot that is being done. And I'm really thankful that people are shifting things and doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just also be aware of how society, I know that's like a vague word, but how people try to brainwash you, whether it's through history, whether it's through fucking movies. An entire genre is based on Native Americans, like, being Indians versus cowboys. Like, it's just like, what? Like, I can't even comprehend the levels of ignorance that has to, like, that utilizes that. But even like in recent history, there was like that movie The Lone Ranger, even that was like in recent history. Like, I think being aware of all these things and not being susceptible to being brainwashed, I think, is so important, because you can't really take a history book at face value, because you know where it's from. You can't really take this movie at face value, because this is the source. So I think empowering people of that community in particular to make things, like, whether it's reservation dogs or something, right? So it's, I think we're seeing baby steps, and I'm excited to see where those land, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I really encourage people to engage in indigenous content, like authored by indigenous mm-hmm. peoples and made by indigenous peoples. I think reservation dogs, Rutherford Falls, Molly of Denali. There's so many wonderful things that are emerging now, which is so great to see, because historically it's just been so poorly done. There's some very weird spin-off narratives that involve the Lone Ranger and that actor who put a bird on his head and had a Native American identity rather mm-hmm. suddenly, it seems like. Mm. And so there was a lot of strange things that went on in there. And then also, like, being Native American, you just get all these weird, like, little pieces of crap that just fall into your hands sometimes. I remember I was on a flight, and I opened the magazine because I was just sort of waiting for us to take off or something. And there was an article in there about Kevin Costner being adopted by Native American peoples after Dances with Wolves. Hmm. And he said, so they gave him like an indigenous name. And in his speech, he said, "Now when I fly over this land, I'll know that there's not nothing here." And I thought, could they just take the name back? Can they just say, wow. Yeah, get out of here. Because it's just such a weird thing to say.
And I can't believe that. So ignorant.
And then he went and did Yellowstone, which, if you've seen it, the Native American people look that great.
That is so ignorant.
There's an energy in that show that's like, God, can you believe they just want their land back? It's like, what the fuck is happening?
Inconvenience.
His energy is like, I'm keeping my land away from corporations and those damn Native Americans who believe it's theirs. It's like, okay, this is too much.
Yeah.
This is too much.
And I think someone recently said, and then our show didn't get any awards because Rutherford Falls made a show that made fun of our show that they watched on their show.
Yeah.
I don't know about that.
God, what a roundabout way of saying, like, we suck.
That's a white guy who said that.
Yeah. Yeah.
We don't suck. It's their fault.
Yeah, exactly.
The Native Americans did it to us.
Well, yeah, you recycled the concept of cowboys v. Indians and then added corporations as
exactly.
well. Exactly. Like, it's not exactly...
It's not fucking rocket science. You're just, like, re-clothing something into something else.
Well, I think there's something to this as well. Like, when we talk about decolonization, when we talk about anti-racism work, like, I do think there's a significant number of people whose concept is... Okay, now they want to genocide me because that's right. the only alternative, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm the one who's going to have to suffer now. And you hear these things when people say, well, let's talk about the real racism, which is how hard it is to be white in America and to be a white male, especially. And so we're hearing that narrative where people are honestly believing that their lives are probably more difficult than anyone else's has ever been.
Yeah.
Simply because it's not always about them all the time, and they're not allowed to be just a default identity now.
Right.
And so one example would be the Violence Against Women Act. And so there's a thing in the Violence Against Women Act, which I guess the short version is, if you're not Native American, you can be removed from Native American justice systems. So like if you're on a reservation and you caused harm to someone, they could say, nope, the tribal courts and stuff cannot prosecute you. We'll do it at the federal level. And what the Violence Against Women Act did probably well over a decade ago was said, well, in the instance of domestic violence, that's not the case. They'll have to stay and be tried by the Native American justice system. And there was a senator from Alaska who exempted Alaska from this law. And Alaska has the highest rates of violence against women in the nation. And when you look at Native American women, it's absolutely, it's unfathomable how bad it is.
Yeah.
And so to say Alaska won't be in the Violence Against Women Act. Like, we'll keep our violence against women. And then there was someone who was an editor of a newspaper who wrote an article that said, if white people are tried in Native American courts, they will never have a fair trial. And so that to me says, I know that the justice system is unfair currently for Native American people. So if they develop their own system, they will have to be unfair against us, which is this whole idea, like, everybody's trying to be like me.
Yeah.
And I got to where I am as an ethnicity, as a race, by oppressing everybody. And so if I'm not doing that, then I'm going to be oppressed just like we have. And those things just need to be unpacked, because that's not what we're going for at all. We're actually going for removing oppression.
I think it's a very interesting indication of, like, the most primitive mindset is like, oh, I'm being attacked. That must mean, like, they're going to win, like, or something. Like, I have to be the winner. I have to be the best or whatever. That's the most primitive mindset in the world, is, like, really feeling so threatened by something that's just about inclusion versus, like, taking of power, which would be great still. But it's not even the basis of that argument. I don't know. So when they talk about being primitive, like, that's, there it is, in my opinion.
That's so devastating, since, like, indigenous women are, like, notorious for going missing and murdered without any sort of, like, repercussion or even any sort of, like, real report on it. Like, it's just a thing that we let happen.
Yeah.
As if they matter less.
And Native Americans are the only race that experienced the majority of their violent crimes from outside of their race. So the majority it's white perpetrators. And so, especially against women. And so some of these things where you say, like, a Native American woman is three times likely to be a victim of a sex crime in her life, and there's an 80% chance that that's going to be a white male. And so the fact that we don't talk about these things, again, it's this extension of colonial violence, because mm-hmm. the stories that we tell is we say, as soon as they built a Navy base here, that's when our women started washing up on the beaches, and we get our clan identity through our mothers. And so mm-hmm. as we go forward with trying to call more attention to murdered and missing Indigenous women and trying to create real shift and real change, like, we're continually pushing to create a better world where our women can just, they could just go places yeah. and do things and not have to think about, well, I've got to bring a friend or else I might just disappear. Mm-hmm. And to also think, you know, the narrative that people used to talk about here as well is in the town that I live in, if you were a victim of a sexual assault and you're a Native American woman, if you called the police, you're probably going to get another sexual assault on you by that police officer. And so trying to come to grips with those things as well, it's like violence on top of violence on mm-hmm. top of violence. And so trying to overcome all of those things, a lot of it is just trying to say, let's examine what's really going on here so we can foundationally change the coming generations. You could do quite a bit with the current generation, but you also, there's a point where you gotta give up on them a little bit and say, okay, well, we need to teach these kids how to be human beings and how to be compassionate, how to be respectful, and how to love themselves and then to love each other. And then hopefully have a world where a lot less of this stuff is gonna happen.
Yeah, it really does start with childhood, because children are so impressionable and their view of the world is informed so much by the first several years of their life. I mean, like, you can look at Pocahontas, for example. Like, that story was watched by so many young people, and that was maybe their first introduction to Native American culture or anything, or their first introduction to any kind of history about white people coming here. And so that's also a part of, like colonization and whitewashing and brainwashing, because those impressionable children will have that as the basis of their knowledge, right? And everything else is like, oh, I didn't know that, but this is what happened here. And, like, it's just all such a, it's all false. It's all just this big fallacy. And I think on the other side of that, giving kids the right information and the truth also is impressionable to them. And I think there's so much hope in that being an option versus the alternative.
Okay. Sounds good.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. You've been such a joy to talk to. Again, I think I understand what Anna was saying about learning so much, because I think I learned a lot in the last hour. So I'm excited.
Just wait till you hear Hane's podcast, Tongue Unbroken.
I'm excited to have people listen to it. Let's say it one more time.
Tongue Unbroken.
Perfect.
Wherever you get your podcast.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Hane. Did I say it? Decently yeah. well. Do you want to plug any socials you want people to follow you on, if you want to be followed, all the good stuff?
Yeah. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, usually under my Indigenous name. So I think if you, I don't know, you got to look for Hane or Do Ani Kau Dinuk. Maybe we could.
I'll tag them.
Drop some links somewhere. And then, I am going to roll out like a Tongue Unbroken social media presence. It'll be out by the time this podcast is mm-hmm. airing, so that there's some spaces where I can just post a lot of information about Native American language revitalization, opportunities, ways to collaborate. If folks are out there trying to figure out, like, where do I even start, or what's my next step? Like, I just want us to have more and more of those conversations and just keep building momentum until Native American language revitalization and decolonization is just a big wave that's just making things better. Mm-hmm. So, Kunachish, I'm so thankful for this opportunity and to spend time with you.
Oh, thank you.
Anytime. Yeah, thank you. And that's the show. You know where to follow us if you want to follow us. Ethnically Amb on Twitter, Ethnically Amb Big on Instagram. I mean, more importantly, go listen to Tongue Unbroken. Is it Tongue or Tongues?
Tongue.
Tongue. So I got it right. Tongue Unbroken, and follow Hane and all all the things he's working on. That's far more important, I feel like, at this current moment than following your podcast. But yeah, thank you for listening.
Yeah, go check that out. Out now. And support all the Next Up Slate shows that we like to talk about on this podcast. And yeah, bye. Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.